Yesterday's primary in Missouri and several other states may have been a turning point in the selection of a Democratic nominee for 2020. Joe Biden won 4 out of 6 states in play yesterday, including Missouri. Bernie Sanders still has a mathematical shot, but it's slim. And whereas Biden gave a speech casting himself as the presumptive nominee, Sanders did not address his supporters when the results came in, but instead went home to Vermont. If you've been taking in the news this morning, you already know all of this. But when it comes to how people are feeling, the takeaways you have access to are likely to be those of your friends and families, people you know. And that might skew one way or the other. So today, we're taking the temperature here in Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us how you're feeling the morning after the Missouri primary. If you voted, we also want to know about your experience at the polls. 816-235-2888. My guest is Elizabeth Vonnemy. She's with us from the Political Science Department at UMKC. Hi, Beth.
Good morning.
What are the biggest takeaways for you this morning?
Well, I think the likelihood of a Sanders nomination has narrowed substantially. You said it's mathematically possible, but I think it's not feasible at this point without a huge showing in the next few contests. So I think that's the big takeaway. I think the second big takeaway has to do with young voters and the fact that they're just not turning out in the numbers that the Sanders camp needs them to turn out in.
We talked just last week with a bunch of young college-age voters on this show. You were here for that. We heard
right.
a lot of enthusiasm for the process, for the issues, but less enthusiasm for the remaining candidates. Do you see that reflected in what happened yesterday in Missouri and elsewhere?
I think so. So I've looked at the exit polls for Missouri, and the first-time voters, whether they're young or not, split evenly between the two candidates. But it is the case that the under 40 really went for the Sanders camp. The problem is they're only about 28% of the electorate in Missouri. And that means that, you know, even if you do really well among that 28%, you've got to pick up older voters. And I think we're just not seeing that traction like we saw in 2016 for Sanders.
Elizabeth Warren announced that she was getting out of the race just as we began the conversation
right.
we were having last week. Like, our guests were in the studio and
right.
heard that over NPR. Do you think that her departure and the timing of it might have affected the psychology of people who had been gunning for her heading into the polls? Voter psychology is your expertise.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think the fact that she didn't endorse one of the candidates before Michigan and Missouri does sort of left a lot of her supporters sort of floundering. Do I go with the progressive wing and go with Sanders, or do I go with sort of the known quantity and Joe Biden? And I think
and the candidate, all of the other former candidates seem to have
right.
been endorsing.
Right. And so I think at least among my colleagues and friends that were Warren supporters, they were split. So some of them were, you know, I'm going to go with the progressive side and go with Sanders. Others were, you know, well, we need to win. And so they went with Biden.
Mayor Quentin Lucas has made national headlines for being turned away at the polls when he went to vote early
right.
yesterday morning. Turns out they'd been looking for Lucas Quinton instead of Quentin Lucas. But as he has pointed out in several interviews now, he's someone with the flexibility to come back later. He had additional forms of valid ID, like a passport, which he could run home and grab in a part of the country where lots of folks don't have passports. And he also had, you know, access to all of the media
right.
To tell his story. My question for you is how this news coming out over the course of the day yesterday might have affected people, their decisions, their behavior, even their decisions about whether to bother heading to the polls.
I think it could. I've done some research on what happens to voters when, you know, well-known politicians talk about voter fraud or talk about mishandling of election results. And those things actually have a pretty tremendous effect on voters. Their confidence in the election wanes when you have that kind of scenario. This isn't an atypical situation either. Something similar happened to me in 2008, where I asked for an absentee ballot and then it didn't arrive. So I went to the polls early. And they were like, oh, no. You're trying to commit voter fraud. And I was like, no, I'm literally a political science professor. This is ridiculous. And, you know, they, after a few phone calls, they were like, okay, we'll let you vote. But it was a similar situation where I was like, really? Is this really happening to me right now? And I'm sure that's how he felt as well. But yes, it can have an effect on people's sort of willingness to show up to vote.
I mean, you're getting at this other thing. One of our reporters went out to the polls and met other people who also encountered difficulty voting yesterday in Kansas City. I had a little bit of a run around myself. It was easily resolved, but it does require a little bit of patience to stick with it and resolve it. And I wonder, you know, someone being sent from poll worker to poll worker at their voting location or having to get back in line, go someplace else. One guy I met actually had been to four different places and was back where he'd started that morning when I was voting yesterday evening. What determines whether someone sticks with it or not?
Well, I actually think there's some real inequality in that sort of whether people eventually are able to vote, because it does require a persistence, but also a confidence that you know that you're in the right here. And I think that often comes with, you know, education, right? You know that you are eligible to vote. You know that you've done everything right. But somebody who's voting for the first time, or somebody who, you know, is more trusting of poll workers and what they've said, is going to be turned off by participating.
Let's talk to Andrew calling us from Columbus Park. Hi, Andrew.
Hey.
What do you want to share?
I don't know. I feel kind of disappointed that Bernie lost by such a large margin, and I don't know. I feel like a lot of younger people should have gone out to vote. I didn't see a whole lot of young people at my polling station, and I don't know. I just feel like we're going to be in for a repeat of 2016.
So you're a Democrat staring down November and feeling worried based on what happened yesterday?
Yeah. I think it's going to come down to Biden versus Trump, obviously, and it's going to be people are going to be thinking they have to pick the lesser of two evils again, and I don't know. I don't think it's looking good.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. I'm going to take one more call, and then Beth will talk about this. Jenny in Kansas City, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
And I just wanted to say that I feel really good about Biden winning. I like Bernie, but I think he's just too far left, and I think Biden's a safer choice, more moderate, and he definitely agrees with my values and priorities, you know, from the speeches. So
what values and priorities are those specifically? Because I feel like so much of what we hear about both of these candidates has to do with who is in a better position to beat Trump. But you hear actual values being reflected that you identify with. What are those?
The values are expanding Obamacare or Medicare. I mean, I know that they both are talking about that, but healthcare is kind of the number one with me, and then also talk about the taxing, making the taxing more fair, making the rich carry more of their share. I don't think there's really, like I said, that much difference in the way that they each talk about those issues, but it just seems like Bernie goes a little too far left for me.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. Beth, what do you hear in these first two calls? Which is not a large sample size.
Sure. But I actually think it's great because I think they reflect sort of exactly how people are feeling the day after the primary, which is Bernie Sanders supporters feeling discouraged and disappointed. And, you know, they have legitimate concerns about whether or not Biden has what it takes to beat Trump in November. And I think for most Democrats, that's the key, is beating Trump in November. And I think, you know, to give Andrew a little bit of, you know, some hope, I'm going to say, you know, one of the things Biden's doing that Clinton wasn't able to do in 2016 at this point is getting more suburban voters and working class voters. He's doing much better among that sector, including independents that are working class voters. And so that might help in a November contest against Trump.
What do you make of yesterday's kerfuffle in Michigan with a little bit of a shouting match over gun rights and the Second Amendment and some expletives?
You know, so I think for Biden supporters, I don't think they're surprised, right? And I actually think Democrats generally who've been paying attention for years to Joe Biden would not be surprised. He's more similar in that way to Trump in the sense that he does, you know, talk he lets his emotions get to him sometimes, and so he says things that other candidates are like, I can't believe you said that to a voter.
I'm wondering about the optics of that kind of argument with someone in a hard hat specifically. I guess coming off of your thing about like working class voters.
Right. And I think, you know, so the particulars of it might be a little problematic for Biden. But I think one thing that Biden gets that other candidates don't is a little bit of some benefit of the doubt, in the sense that he's always been that kind of candidate and that kind of politician, where he's blunt, he says what he thinks, and he doesn't seem to be bothered if you are uncomfortable when he says that, because he wants to tell you the truth. And I think that perspective might be okay in this kind of scenario, especially against somebody like Donald Trump, who is very blunt and in your face about things.
Okay, we have some clips from our reporter, Noah Taborda, who went out and talked to lots of people yesterday about who they were voting for and why. I want to play a clip from a Sanders supporter that he met in Hyde Park. He's 52 years old.
He's for civil rights. He's for LGBTQ rights. He wants to make sure everybody has a livable wage and health care. Which seems apparently to be the complete opposite of what else is going on currently. So that's not the I mean, I'm not going for that because it's the polar opposite. I'm going for that because those are my values. But yeah, I would much rather go far to the left to combat the far right, as opposed to just being like, well, we'll make some concessions and we'll continue all the wars and stuff like that.
I want to just contrast that with what we heard from a 36-year-old voter who turned out for Biden. Here's what he said when we asked why.
Restore normalcy, you know, right? Just a return to sanity. No more crazy.
So is their reasoning emblematic of something we should be talking about?
You know, I think it's interesting because they both are, I think, reacting against the status quo, reacting against the Trump administration, but going from it from two very different angles, which is, you know, the status quo is not good, and so let's go as far to the left as we can with the first voter. And then the other, which is the status quo is not good, so let's try to move it back to the middle and, you know, make everyone a little bit happier. And so it is a very, I mean, they're very different approaches, but I think it's all this reaction against the current situation and this anxiety over what's currently happening and just reacting to it in two very different ways, but for the same reason, I think.
We are hearing a little bit of like Biden being cast as, we heard one caller say, the lesser of two evils, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I mean, when you look at the actual policy positions of Joe Biden and how those compare to Bernie Sanders, how those compare to Donald Trump, is that characterization, do you find that something that is becoming like a talking point more than reflecting a reality, or does it reflect a reality?
I actually think when people talk about Biden being the safe choice, I don't actually think they have ideology or policy in mind at all. I think what they're talking about is, we know what we're going to get in Joe Biden. We know who he is and how he's going to react and what kind of experience he has when under pressure and sort of as having been brought vice president. I don't really think they're talking ideology. I think they're talking leadership. And I think that's where Biden has the edge at this point over Sanders, because I think most Democrats like many of the policies that Sanders is talking about. And I don't think Biden is all that different policy-wise than Sanders would be if they could both be in the same room and honest with each other. So I really think it's about personality and leadership than it is values or ideology.
Let's talk to Larry in Kansas City. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Oh, fine. I voted for Joe Biden yesterday, and I was happy that he won, and I'm excited about his candidacy. I just wanted to respond to the customer a few minutes. The caller.
That's what I'm going to call people.
The caller a few minutes ago. I worked 32 years in retail, so the word customer just pops into my head. But the caller that said a choice between Trump and Biden was a choice between two evils. I mean, that just offended me. A few years ago, I was in the Kansas City Public Library. I picked up a biography of Joe Biden. I suggest people read that book. I'm sorry, I don't remember the author, but it was, Joe Biden's a fine individual. I think he'd make a good president. I'm sorry. These people that lose an election and whine and claim the other person is evil, that's just nonsense. Joe Biden's a good man, and people ought to realize that. And that's all I had to say.
Well, Larry, thank you. You know, this... I don't think we can determine in this room whether Joe Biden's a good person or not. Like, that's maybe beyond our capacity. However, there has been this pattern I've noticed of when one of the Democratic candidates drops out, the people who had identified really closely with that person, maybe beyond even just identifying with them as a candidate. And I think a lot of women who vote did feel that way about Elizabeth Warren, perhaps, and that... there is this tension between sort of validating some sort of personal grief at losing the prospects for this candidate to become president and kind of stepping back from it and keeping it in perspective and thinking strategically and all these other kinds of things. And maybe, yeah, like not getting too swept up in the, I guess I would say, maybe the ego side of the loss.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to do that. It's really hard when you have supported a candidate for months and years in some cases, and that person isn't doing well or has dropped out, for you just to be like, well, that's done. Time to move on to the next one. That's
Especially incredibly hard.
Yeah, that's incredibly hard. And I don't expect any voter to do that, because we also, and I expect a lot of reasoning and justification, rationalization, because that's what we do. We call it motivated reasoning in the psychological literature, where, you know, when things don't work out the way we want, or we are hearing inconsistent information or negative information about people we like, including politicians, we try to rationalize away that information. Like, well, Joe Biden won because people just are scared that Sanders will change things too much, or, you know, somehow there was some conspiracy afoot. That happens because, you know, people are really, it's hard to come to terms with a loss like that. And we see that with lots of candidates. It happens on both sides of the aisle.
Well, you know, there is this sense that where things are going, where it's all headed, comes largely for a lot of people out there from their social media networks. And I've read a perspective that our social media feeds might make the Democratic Party look less united going into November than it actually is. Do you have thoughts on that?
I do. I have lots of thoughts on social media.
Share them.
But so one of the things I constantly remind my students and myself is that Twitter and Facebook aren't the real world. And this is especially true of Twitter, because you get this real perspective that, you know, the Democratic Party is much more liberal than it is. If you look at the sort of Twitter feeds of Democrats and of supporters of the candidates, and if you actually talk to people, I think you get more in the line with what Larry was presenting, this more moderate take on the world generally than what you're seeing on Twitter. And I think that's true on the Republican side. I don't think Republicans are near as conservative as the social media world presents them to be.
We made like what's being called maybe minor history, although I think it could turn out to be bigger than that in Kansas City, when Biden's speech at the rally this weekend in Kansas City was manipulated to sound like he was backing Trump in a video that went up online. Twitter took it down as the first application of the platform's new rules about manipulated content. Facebook left it up. Thoughts on this and how it relates to how social media impacts voter psychology?
I think it's really dangerous that we have so much misinformation and fake news, so to speak, out there, because it is incredibly hard sometimes to decipher fact from fiction. And so we try really hard in the schools, and this is true not just in universities, but it's increasingly true in high schools as well, and even middle schools, to try to teach students how to distinguish and decipher real news from fake news, because it certainly could, you know, give the impression that things are different than they are. And in this case, I think most voters would recognize that probably wasn't accurate, and so they would reject it outright. But it certainly has the potential to influence people.
Well, Beth Vonnemy, with us from UMKC's Political Science Department, thank you, as always, for your insights.
Sure, thanks a lot.
We'll keep providing election coverage, and we want to hear from you. What's the story when you look at how people are thinking about their votes in your community? Tweet us your observations today, or honestly, whenever. We are at KCURCST. It's time for a break. When Central Standard returns, a boxer and a photographer bonded over civil rights in the 1960s. People following in their footsteps today reflect on their legacy. That's in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now there's an exhibit at the Nelson showing photographs of Muhammad Ali that were taken by Gordon Parks for Life magazine. These two icons of the civil rights movement, icons of Black greatness in very different fields, met a couple of times, and those meetings produced stunning images that show a quiet side of the boxing champ, maybe due in part to a sensitivity that other photographers didn't have for what he was really fighting in that ring. Gordon Parks and Muhammad Ali mean a lot to a lot of people. Kevin Wilmot is one of them. He is an Oscar-winning filmmaker, most recently known for Black Klansman, and he's based in Lawrence. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. Gordon Parks, who took these pictures, was a Black photographer and a filmmaker. Like you, he was from Kansas. Fort Scott, you're from Junction City. We'll get to the biographical similarities in a moment. But what do people need to know about Gordon Parks and the impact of his work if they're not familiar?
Well, Gordon Parks is one of the great ones. And he was the first African-American to direct a studio feature film in Hollywood. And that fact alone is, one of the big ones that I don't think people really kind of acknowledge like they should. I mean, you know, Hollywood in the late 60s, was just beginning to kind of change the way they looked at African-Americans. And Gordon Parks, it's that old adage about how you've got to be so talented that they can't keep you out kind of. Notion, and that's exactly what Gordon Parks was that he was so talented. He had written a novel that turned into the Learning Tree screenplay, and then he directed the film and was this great photographer and was a poet. And I mean, he was just a total Renaissance man. And so he was just so talented that they really couldn't kind of keep him out. And so that's how the Learning Tree, that was his first film, the Learning Tree, happened.
And then he later made movies like Shaft.
Yes, and he later did Shaft, which was a huge iconic cultural kind of moment for African Americans, especially. And he's just had this huge career, coming kind of from nothing in Fort Scott, kind of stumbled on becoming a photographer. And he has a book called A Choice of Weapons, which he talks about how the camera became his choice of weapon to fight back against, discrimination and oppression and segregation, all those things. And he is one of those figures that made a huge mark in society and helped so many people to achieve their goals and their dreams in the world of the arts.
He made waves with his work for Life magazine, where he was the only Black photographer on staff during the segregation era, where there were places that only he could go, only people only he could interview. The really famous picture he took was the one he called American Gothic, depicting a Black custodial worker named Ella Watson with her mop and her bucket. They met in the Life magazine office building after everyone else had gone home for the day. Talk to me about that image.
Yeah, that's such a great photograph. I mean, it's ironic and satirical but so real and so kind of needed at that moment. I mean, the civil rights movement is just really kind of starting to happen. It's kind of in full throttle by the time you get to the mid 60s. And those photographs that he was taking and being printed in Life magazine, which Life magazine, you can't underestimate the power of that magazine at the time. It was like on every you know, I'm so many people's coffee tables in America, and those photographs that he was taking at the time, you know, they just had a huge effect on viewers and on Americans, especially white America, who are kind of looking at the civil rights movement from the outside, kind of seeing it on the television, and these photographs that would be in Life were just, you know, they were so impactful because that photograph in particular, you know, it's kind of humorous and satirical, but she's a real woman and she's got a real job there, and it allowed he was taking, you know, photographs of what you would really call invisible people. And he was making them visible and putting them in a context that was really affecting Americans.
Do you see a Gordon Parks as in some way paving the way for a Kevin Wilmot, or is that overstating the connection between you?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, I think every black filmmaker in the country has a debt of gratitude to Gordon Parks. I mean, you know, he busted down those doors. I mean, black people, black, you know, men and women, but especially men at the time, because women weren't, there were so few women directors in Hollywood, period. But, you know, they were just not looked at as directors at all. I mean, it just wasn't a concept. And so it doesn't really kind of become a concept, even after Gordon Parks has his success in the 60s, you know, in 69 with Learning Tree. And then he has bigger success with Shaft. Even after that, you know, African Americans were not really looked upon as directors until really I would say Spike Lee had his big success in the 80s.
You know, it's interesting to think about someone being able to pull it off when the people around them still kind of don't imagine them in that role.
Yeah, I think you know, his success is a great kind of example of how you kind of break through the system. I mean, you know, he wrote this novel, The Learning Tree, and it was successful. And you know, he was this Life magazine, you know, photographer, very successful at that. And so no one could deny he had an eye. So he had an eye, and he had a director's eye. And he knew so many other photographers, and he knew the world of New York City and of the arts. And so all of that kind of put him in a position where he could really kind of do the ask. And so when he, you know, wanted to move forward with the film, it was a lot harder to deny him because of all his other success.
I want you to imagine for a moment being a fly on the wall when Gordon Parks met Muhammad Ali and, as a photographer, took control of the literal lens through which America saw this boxing champion, who at the time was getting a reputation for being immature and, quote, obnoxious. What do you think is significant about this encounter?
Well, you know, I think a lot of folks today older folks kind of know how you know, Muhammad Ali was really kind of perceived back in the days, back in his heyday. And when he was Cassius Clay, before he became Muhammad Ali, you know, he was, as my father would say, he was a showman. And he was a showman, and he was almost like he had a shtick that was like WWE, you know, wrestling kind of stuff. And he was a real entertainer, and you know, I am the greatest. All of that was kind of a shtick, and then when he met Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and joined the Nation of Islam and became Muslim, and changed his name to Muhammad Ali, he was despised, and there's no other word for it. He was despised. And people, you know, he has all these fights where people won't call him Muhammad Ali, his new name, and so it's a huge thing that when Gordon Parks meets him, and he's now Muhammad Ali, he put a human face to him, really. And I remember just even myself, you know, when when Ali would have fights, and if he would lose, the next day when you would go to work, it's like I'm in high school, the next day you would go to work, you know, there would just be, all your white buddies would love to rub it in that he lost. And it's so amazing now to see him as this beloved figure. But during that time, he was really despised. And so Gordon Parks really kind of puts a human face on him. I think they're, you know, they're equals. They are black men in this case who are, have kind of crossed these barriers that you're not supposed to be in these spaces. And they're in the space, and you know, I've got to meet both of them, and I didn't really get to meet Ali. I got to shake his hand a couple of times.
That's still pretty cool.
Yeah. But they were both very, you know, open, easy to talk to kind of people, and real, and you can, you know, so I'm sure that first meeting with Parks and Ali was one of immediate kind of connection. And Ali was a smart guy, so he knows what Parks is doing. And he knows that he's having this huge power and influence in effect in Life magazine. And so I think that's why you get these amazing photographs of this other side of Muhammad Ali. He is not the showman in those photographs. He is Ali, the human being. And that's what I think gives him so much of their power.
Kevin Wilmot, hang on with me. I want to bring another guest in on this. David Muhammad is the head youth instructor at Integrity Martial Arts Academy in Kansas City. So he's a boxing teacher. He used to teach in the classroom where he was known fondly to his students as Mr. Moo, I believe.
Yeah.
Mr. Moo, David Muhammad, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What about you? If you're a fly on the wall when Gordon Parks meets Muhammad Ali and the two of them are starting to hang out, what do you want to know? What do you imagine that they bond over?
Yeah, I think the humanness of both of them. I think that Mr. Wilmot really highlighted very well the fact that both of them had entered into these spaces where they were othered. And for them to be able to have these moments of taking off the glimmer and taking off the stresses and the pressures of being that one or being that only had to be extremely dynamic. And I think anybody knows that when you're in a space where you feel like you can be your full self, you have these very organic moments. And I'm sure that that's why Gordon Parks was able to get the types of photos that he got, because he wasn't taking pictures of him from the lens of I am the photographer, you are the subject. It was more, I'm your brother in this space.
Yeah, like I see you. I see what's going on with
exactly.
You.
Like I fully see you. This lens is not even the lens of the camera. I'm looking at you through my actual individual lens. And I also got to meet Gordon Parks as well. And he had that something about him that just made you comfortable right away, to the point where probably Ali wasn't even thinking about the fact that he was being photographed. And so I would have loved to just be in that presence.
What does Muhammad Ali mean to you?
Quite a bit. You know, as a young African-American male growing up, one, you know, doing martial arts, my father was a martial arts instructor. There was that connection from fighting and seeing this greatness within him. Two, being a Muslim. So I am a practicing Muslim. And so and being an African-American Muslim at that, Muhammad Ali was always exalted as, you know, as close to prophet like you could get, right, as a kid. You know, we didn't consider him to be a prophet, but I mean, here's a guy who stood up and said, you're going to call me this name, which I happen to have the same last name, you know, my last name is Muhammad. You're going to call me this name, you're going to see me as a man, and if you don't, I'm willing to fight you for it, and I fight you better than anybody else, right? And so that strength, that confidence from a young age put a lot in me, you know, just recognizing, you know, I came in at the aspect when I was a kid of him being considered like the world's hero, right, and America's greatest sportsman. And it wasn't until later in my life as I matured to realize how vilified he had been. You know, I kind of compare it to like a Martin Luther King, right? When you're a kid, oh, I have a dream speech. He was so great. And then you recognize when you get older, like, but people hated him at that time. But even in learning that, it gives a lot of strength to recognizing when you believe in something to stand for it.
Talk to me about boxing, what you love about it, and what inspires you to teach this martial art to young people.
I think that any of the fighting arts, you know, allow people a space to work through emotions that can't always be verbally expressed. And very few of us have access to resources like therapy, you know. So I think that, you know, a lot of youth, they know how they feel, but they don't know how to explain it. And the physical outlet, in my opinion, sometimes is greater than the verbal. And so to see young people have a space where they can come and not only work through emotions, but be able to have a form of an expression. I mean, it's an art, right? Martial art. And boxing, we call it the sweet science as well. You never reach perfection, but you have these moments where you're on. And you see kids step into their light. You see young people step into their individualism and make it work for them, right? Like, not every kid who walks in is the same, whether it's athletic ability, mental, cognitive ability to process. And so I think that that process is very encouraging for me, and I enjoy it.
Do you see the history of boxing in particular in America through a lens of race?
Often I do. I think I can't help but to in many cases. You've had so many great boxing champions who were not only fighting for the physical win, but fighting for what they were standing for, from Joe Louis to Sugar Ray Robinson. They represented more than themselves. They represented a community.
We will get right back to this conversation about Muhammad Ali and Gordon Parks. Photos of Muhammad Ali taken by Gordon Parks are on display now at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about Gordon Parks and Muhammad Ali with two people from our area. David Muhammad with us from Integrity Martial Arts, where he teaches many martial arts, including boxing, and filmmaker Kevin Wilmot, who is joining us from KU. I want to stick with David Muhammad for just a moment to say, you know, talk to me about this transformation of Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, from young bombastic showman to thinker, man of religion.
Yeah. I have to relate it a lot to what I've learned about my father's transition, you know.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
Yeah, my father joined the Nation of Islam when he was, I believe, 18 years old, and went from Rudolph Gregory to Rudolph X to Rudolph Muhammad. And I think with most people, whatever that point is in their life, we all have these transition points that mature us. And for blacks, because we don't have ties to our cultural heritage in many cases, our names are often what symbolize that transition and that growth. And so even people outside of Islamic faith, you see them, you know, maybe discard what they consider to be their slave name or adopt names that embody what they want to represent. And people meet you first through your name, right? How's it going with your name? And so I think him changing his name was a state of his consciousness, him recognizing who he wanted to be and who he wanted to become. And he wanted to garner that respect, you know. And if you won't call a person by their name, then you don't even see them as a human being. And so I think that he was trying to, and he was maturing in that process. You know, I think the Muhammad Ali of 20 is different than the Muhammad Ali of 35 or even of 50. And so he was constantly growing into that name and what it meant.
Jump in here, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. You know, Ali was able to, I think, you know, make that transition to Muhammad Ali at a time when African Americans really were looking to connect to their black self, and you know, the effect that Malcolm X had on him, and the relationship they had, and how, you know, the Nation of Islam was able to really kind of turn Cassius Clay into this you know, American hero, really. And you know, you can't really downplay the effect that that transition has. I mean, it's the same transition that Malcolm X has from Malcolm Little to Malcolm X, and those examples have been huge examples for especially black men in America to kind of leave their old self and find a new self and a really a new life.
You know, the 1966 meeting between Muhammad Ali and Gordon Parks resulted in an article in Life magazine that was also written by Gordon Parks, and it was a profile of Muhammad Ali. He recounts that, you know, when they met, he says to Muhammad Ali, "I'm here to find out if you're as obnoxious as they say you are." Mm. And Muhammad Ali was like, "Yeah, I know. Don't worry about it." What do you make of this conversation between two black men in America out making names for themselves, achieving recognized greatness in their fields in the 1960s?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a pretty interesting one. This was between Parks and Ali, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was the big question. I mean, that's how Ali was perceived at the time.
And his response shows he knew that, you know.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that makes Muhammad Ali such a genius on so many levels, is that he was fully aware. I think he was fully aware of the Cassius Clay image that he created, the showman, and then he was fully aware of the new image he created as Muhammad Ali, and the fact that he was so in tune with, I think, media and image and the power of those things. I think that's why he's the icon he is today, because he didn't he stumbled on it, but it didn't take him by surprise. I think was fully conscious of the effect he was having. And I think he was fully conscious of the power of image and entertainment, because, you know, the thing that's amazing about the Cassius Clay image as opposed to the Muhammad Ali image, he is still entertaining in both worlds. He is still, but it's just a different kind of perception. When he becomes Muhammad Ali, he's still making rhymes. He is still kind of the entertainer, but it is with this now kind of profound understanding of social awareness and of his place in black life and of the oppression that's going on in America. And in later on, obviously, with the corruption of the Vietnam War.
You know, there is a photo in the show at the Nelson where you see Muhammad Ali in a press conference, and there are all these cameras and reporters, this swarm of people around him. It makes him look small because he's just one guy in this situation. And seeing that perspective of him, I mean, is that something that Gordon Parks, you think, was in a particular position to see and to show?
Yeah, I would think so. I think that those photos kind of... That big news conference, there was that great moment where all these black athletes came together to support Muhammad Ali. And Jim Brown was there, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and kind of all of the top kind of black athletes at the time came out in this big, huge press conference to kind of stand with Ali. And you know, so the black community kind of knew he was under attack and that they were trying to really kind of destroy him. And so that smallness that he looks at, that he appears in the photograph is kind of the David and Goliath image that he was up against at the time. I mean, he suffered a great deal those years where he was banned from boxing. And you can imagine not being able to perform your art, as David mentioned.
And, why was he banned from boxing?
Well, because of his unwillingness to go to the Vietnam War. When he rejected the draft, so already people had despised him because of his showmanship with the Cassius Clay, and then when he becomes Muhammad Ali and refuses to fight in Vietnam, he takes on a total political kind of hate that that I just don't think people can imagine. Just a personal kind of struggle that is.
David Muhammad, jump back in here and tell me your thoughts about, you know, these guys and their encounter and their recognition in a way of how this much forces much larger than them are perceiving probably both of them, even if it's being translated very differently.
Yeah, I think what was coming to my mind as Kevin was speaking so eloquently is the fact that there was probably societal pressures that did not want minds like this to connect. And I think that both Gordon Parks and Muhammad Ali recognized that they were stronger together than they were apart. And, you know, even that conversation where Gordon Parks is asking him, are you as obnoxious as they say you are? What I envision is that it's probably somewhat from a sarcastic tone of, you know, I see you for who you really are. And let's go ahead and get that out the way and see where we can start from a new space. And so, you know, I think when we look at these types of figures, we have to recognize that all the sacrifices they made and how we look at them now is not how they were perceived then. And that oftentimes in our glamorization of these figures, we leave out the realities that they faced. I mean, as Kevin mentioned, you know, he not only was he stripped of his title, I mean, he lost his source of income. You know, so his family was financially struggling. He was hated. He was considered a traitor to this country. And so in that space, he still stood very strong. And I think that Gordon Parks was able to continue to make him feel whole and continue to be a source of human identity through him.
You know, I also understand that he was very hurt when, after winning a championship title, that he got a call among civil rights leaders, civil rights icons. The only call that he got congratulating him was from Martin Luther King Jr., and yes, that was a source of real pain for him.
Absolutely. I mean, his own people, right? Like that he looked to for who he was standing up for even spoke out against him and didn't come to his support. And so in those moments of being alone and being vulnerable, you know, I can't imagine what he was going through.
You've mentioned that you have met Gordon Parks. Talk
yes.
to me about, it's so natural to talk to you about Muhammad Ali because of your relationship with boxing, your relationship with the Nation of Islam. But talk to me about Gordon Parks and what he means to you.
Yeah, so I went to junior college in Fort Scott Community College and played basketball. Well, I set the bench down there trying to play basketball. But in that time, you can't go anywhere in Fort Scott and not hear about Gordon Parks, especially since I was very active in the community. People were always, you know, trying to teach me more about it, and you see signs about the learning tree and such. And so he had decided he was never going to go back to Fort Scott because of the experience he had growing up there. And they made an award, Choice of Weapons Award, named after him. And the first person who got the award was Richard Roundtree, who starred in Shaft. And so there was a push to get Gordon to come back, and they finally got him to come back. And I was able to be a part of that process where I was helping out with the award ceremony and got to meet him. And, I mean, he was as debonair up to his last days as he had always been. And it was just really an honor to meet a true icon, a true hero.
And do you impart some of the history regarding either of these two men to the students who you work with?
Yeah, I think for me, what Gordon Parks has imparted upon myself that I got from that period is like the idea of him being a Renaissance man. Like, he was not only talented in other areas, but he excelled in so many areas. And I think for me, what that tells me to show students is that you're not a monolith. Right. And you can evolve. So at this stage of your life, you may be into this, but that doesn't mean that in 10 years you won't be involved in this, or you can't do both simultaneously. And so Gordon Parks is one that I think a lot of kids don't know about. They see his work without even knowing that it's his, you know.
That is an interesting thing about him.
Absolutely.
That, you know, so much of his work goes out into the world without his name kind of front and center.
And even kids who go to the school, right? Like, they don't, I mean, I'm sure that
Gordon Parks Elementary.
Absolutely. Like,
here in Kansas City.
His impact is beyond measure. And I think that those are the kind of stories that kids need to hear, because only so many people can be a Muhammad Ali. Like, you know, but any kid can pick up a camera or draw or write a script or tell their story and be empowered that their story matters. And I think that that's the value of having this broad wealth of resources to come from, of different types of individuals that we can look at and see ourselves in.
Kevin Wilmot, you know, Gordon Parks, part of his story is that he was the son of, you know, people who worked the land in Kansas, and he didn't finish high school, I believe. He picked up that camera and worked his way up to being the first black photographer at Life magazine.
Yeah, you know, his story is a real great one. I mean, he kind of jumps a freight and goes and out into the world and kind of stumbles onto this camera and from nothing kind of became this great artist. And it's a real lesson for all of us about the power of determination.
Filmmaker Kevin Wilmot joining us from KU. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kevin is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker. You can look up all of our past interviews with him at kcur.org. And David Muhammad from Integrity Martial Arts, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we will talk on this show about sick leave in America and what happens if workers can't just stay home when they're sick. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. Tune in for that. You can talk to us anytime between now and tomorrow on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and you can pull up today's show or any of our past shows at kcur.org/Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and lots of help today from Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.